plot that I had given over the course of the year. And because I had moved the sort of state of the library talk, not really quite the state of the library, but to the all staff meeting, so that many people, many more people could hear about the achievements of the library and the look ahead. But it turned out that the talks I've been giving this year, I was just out in the West Coast in Portland and Orange County, California, and in Las Vegas, giving talks on Google and whether Google was going to put libraries out of business. I've really talked about that before. And then the other talks I've been giving have been on digital publishing and the activities that we have underway. I thought that was perhaps not as valuable for this group. So I have, I've been quite fascinated to be reading the proceedings of various conferences and at meetings that I've attended, where people are really talking about the future and what is happening. And I wanted to, for my own sense, to be able to try to look at that. So that's what I'm presenting. I would consider this very much a work in progress, and I would really look forward to getting your comments, both about what I'm saying, but what am I not saying that should be included in this? I think that's really important. I couldn't resist, however, since I have been traveling so much, and this is like I've got this captive audience of 100 people. I'm going to show you my slides. I'm hard at work in Newport Beach, California. I got an email from someone who I assumed was the Cornell Alumni Affairs coordinator, because this person was asked, his name is Everett Phillips, and I thought that it was actually a woman because it's Everett with two T's and an E on the end, was asking me, oh, was there anybody I wanted to meet when I was out on the trip? You know, what about the university librarians at Irvine and UCLA? So, you know, I really said, oh, yeah, I'd like to see them. And he turned out to be just an alum. He just sort of took it upon, and he said he would meet us for breakfast, Mary Sue and me. And we had a wonderful room. He's really very, very plugged into technology. And he sent me last night something called a Xenia. It's a way of looking at magazines that sort of replicates the paper environment, makes it easier, and provides a softer interface. So I think he's going to be an excellent person for us to know. But after we had our breakfast, he said, well, I've got to show you a few things. And so he took us on this little ferry across to that Balboa Island that we went to. And there's Mary Sue. So just to let you know, I mean, we're really out there doing our best for you. And then we did go to Las Vegas. And there's a fellow we usually see on the California trip called George Joblo, who is a vice president for digital something at Sony. And he's the guy who oversees the people that, you know, if you see Tom Hanks in the Polar Express, and they've taken movies of Tom Hanks, but then they sort of digitally remaster them, and it's Tom is like a cartoon character overlaid over this person's body. It's his group that does this, and he said they basically hired, 900 people? They're hiring, like, 600 people, and it's like two people a day, these digital artists that they're hiring. And they sort of have exhausted the talent in the United States, and they're looking about going over to India and doing that. Well, he happened to be at a big conference in Las Vegas, not in California. We usually see him in California. And so he invited us to meet him at the Paris Hotel. Paris Hotel, anybody been there before?
Yeah, Barbara has been there. Okay.
Well, you can't really see it too well in the back, but that's like a mock Eiffel Tower that goes up through the building. And he invited us for lunch in the Eiffel Tower restaurant. And we had, I did not put a single quarter
in a machine. It would have been a way to cover our deficit, but but I couldn't resist showing you that. And then, anybody know who this is? Lynn Personius, that's right.
When I was giving my well, as I was being driven to the Las Vegas talk, I said, oh, geez, you know, I'm sure if Lynn Personius had known about this, she would have come. It would have been nice to see Lynn. And there she was, Lynn and Alan. For those of you who are new to the Cornell University Library, Lynn Personius used to work in library systems, really led library systems, and was a wonderful person who one day put her resume on Monster Track and moved out to Las Vegas. And she did have some children out there, so it was great to reconnect with her. And then last slide to show you that there was actually a little bit more work being done. This is Baker Library at Harvard. This is the Business School Library, which has been redone to a fairly well. And in fact, they were very proud showing us that there were computers and people had coffee and there were books, and so it was this wonderful environment. And I should say that afterwards, some people were taking me aside and saying, didn't you think that was excessive? And because it was, you know, you went in the stacks and everything was like just, ziplocked in plastic bags in absolute perfection. But it was I thought it was very handsome myself. So that was my last trip. And then I'll just say the advisory council was here. And they met and loved what they heard about the library and the staff. They advised us on our campaign case statement. And I would like to say that we have, in the last 2 years, it's $9.3 million that the library has raised. And that's about a 50% increase over what we normally would have done, and the year is not over yet. So I'm actually very, very pleased with how the campaign is developing. And then this is a slide that I led with when I was meeting with the Library Advisory Council, and since these folks weren't actually mentioned in my staff achievements, I just want to say that it's really remarkable that we have 3 presidents of professional associations in the span of 1 year in our library. I really don't think you would find another university. We have in the lower right-hand corner, Bonna Betcher, who I saw way in the back. Yes, Bonna, who's the president of the Music Library Association. Claire Germain, with the American Association of Law Libraries. And then up in the upper right-hand corner, sort of looking like a magician. Anybody know who that is? Mark Funk, who's incoming president of the Medical Library Association, and also obviously a bit of an artist to do that. But really, it's quite a remarkable achievement. And so I just wanted to have that. I guess I'll wait before I get to that. We've also had, in the space of 1 year, or will have had, in the space of 1 year, 3 national or international level conferences on campus that the library has organized. So we had the very highly influential Janus Conference, where we had an opportunity to hear the leaders from across the country, and of course it was a tribute to Ross Atkinson. We are really, I'm so pleased to hear the developments from the Janus Conference, that it has legs. It is really going out there and transforming what is happening. So that's just a terrific thing, and planned very ably by John Saylor and his group, his merry band. USAIN is coming in October, and I'm particularly happy that is happening, because
I actually, in Portland, Oregon, helped, I remember the room I was meeting in, helped write the bylaws for USAIN, which is the United States Agricultural Information Network, back when I was at the National Agricultural Library. This is being organized by Janet McHugh and Mary Oakes and others, and will bring a number of leaders to campus. And then IPRES, which is an international conference on preservation, is being co-chaired by Tom Hickerson and Ann Kenny. I want to say, and the reason I'm spending so much time on this is I'm a bit humble when I get to talking about the grand challenges, that they're going to seem very familiar to you. And that's, I would say, that if they seem familiar, it's because you are working as leaders and among leaders here at Cornell University. And you're really shaping the future in a way that few organizations that I know do so broadly and so deeply. So when I was thinking about this, a grand challenge, it's associated with the sweeping goals of the 90s, such as the effort to decode the human genome. And I tried to look up in, on the internet about grand challenge from Wikipedia. You know, it's these unsolved problems. There is some subjectivity, and it has these characteristics. Something that requires several orders of magnitude improvement in capability was required to solve it. But the problem does actually have to be solvable. You have some measures that would tell you whether you were attaining that goal, and it's got to have a major social or economic impact. The Grand Challenge, DARPA has been offering the Grand Challenge, and this is actually the Cornell robotic car where they go out and try to go over like 162-mile rugged terrain without a driver and to win a couple million-dollar prize. So it's in this idea that one day there will be cars that can cover terrain without drivers. And we need to think about what are our grand challenges and how we can contribute to this advancement, laying the foundation for deeper human understanding and the development of potent new knowledge. So I want to propose these six areas as grand challenges. And then I'm not spending a lot of time talking about why they are grand challenges, but then moving on to, well, what does that mean for us locally? What are we going to be contributing to? Let's see. So here are the first three that I've identified. Transforming the whole of recorded human knowledge into digital form, building the cyber infrastructure to support the transmission and use of data, information, and ideas on a global scale, enabling the discovery, use of the breadth and depth of the world's knowledge, and then facilitating the free flow of information, saving the accumulated knowledge and cultural assets for future generations, and then creating a workforce that has the skills and capability to achieve these goals. So here, I'm quite sure that there are others, and I'd like to hear what you would think. But as we look at this, the granular challenge, transforming the whole of human knowledge into digital form. A few years ago on the library board, David Cullum, who is a professor of chemistry, said, why don't you just digitize everything? Why don't you just do what they're doing for the human genome? And I can remember I asked Ross to provide some information as to what that would cost. And, and Ross kind of screwed up his face and sorry, this is absurd. And then he went off and pulled some numbers. But David never really took no for an answer. But today, it doesn't really seem so naive. We were sort of poo-pooing him, but we have the Google Book Project, Google Print, Open Content Alliance, Amazon's Inside the Book, the Million Book Project, and Project Gutenberg, Francis Gallica, and many other initiatives are parts of trickles and brooks, streams and floods, perhaps, forming together to form this ocean of information. And textual documents are rapidly being joined by audio and visual materials and data. So we're really seeing that happen. Now, we've been a pioneer in reformatting published literature and primary sources. The Core Historical Literature of Agriculture, HEART, Making of America, and now with Project Euclid, we're adding to the body of digitized maps. I think that what we have to do is not to decide whether or not we should contribute to this mass digitization or large-scale digitization, but how we should do that. So we do have a policy on how to select materials, so that might actually be the easier part. With whom we should partner is perhaps more difficult. Actually, Google has not invited us, nor have they responded to an expression of interest on our part. On the other hand, there are many people who feel that it is not good to be part of the Google effort, that there are issues relating to neutrality of that information or the commercialization of that information that make Google not such a good partner. The Open Content Alliance, on the other hand, has invited our participation, and that's something we should evaluate. They have not, they've signed on a number of partners. They don't seem to have gained much traction. Some of my colleagues have said, it's really going to cost quite a lot of money, and we're not sure about the stability of it. So we really need to evaluate that. Man Library is sending books to be scanned to be part of the Million Book Project. We've contributed to the RLG Cultural Materials Initiative, and we're part of the DLF's Aquifer Project. So we need to examine the various advantages of these partnerships, determine if we can engage in multiple non-exclusive arrangements, because we don't actually just have to say we'll go with one, we could go with multiple. It's just a question of is that fragmenting our effort in some way? Should we do that? And then the part that's been continually difficult for me is how do we fund this activity? We've had wonderful success in getting grants. We can continue to do that. What are the internal means that we have available? So I, and the JNAC conference actually talked about committing funds internally for this. I think we could invest locally in the creation of digitized files in the areas where Cornell really already shines, areas like agriculture, history of science, labor history, and other such areas of specialization. Build the cyberstructure or cyber infrastructure to support the transmission of data, information, and ideas on the global scale. Dan Atkins, who was at the University of Michigan, who had leadership roles both in engineering school of information, is going to be going to NSF this June to head up the Office of Cyber Infrastructure. He wrote a report and chaired a group that was writing a report on cyber infrastructure, and he dined out a lot on talking about that report, so you may have read it. And this is according to the press release announcing the cyber infrastructure office. They will have $182 million to make competitive merit-based awards for leading-edge IT infrastructure essential for science engineering. At some of these conferences that I've been attending, there's been a lot of discussion about e-science and data curation. And I think that falls into this issue of cyber infrastructure. One person I heard recently was Liz Lyon, who's head of CULM and a partner in the UK's Digital Curation Center. And she talked very persuasively about the importance of data curation and the need for librarians to be
in the labs of the chemists and other scientists contributing to the act of data capture, data mining, and data archiving. The paper notebooks have given way to laptops and PDAs, and this information may be very unstable unless information managers are engaged in the creation and preservation material. I think some of that is what Janet will be looking at. I think others have been looking at it. There's also, the cyber infrastructure word caught on, then people said, well, what about the humanities and social sciences? So the American Council of Learned Societies had a group that did something for the humanists. And they talked about the need for tools and standards, digitization of bodies and materials, policies that support openness and access, and centers for innovation, research, and teaching. They were really struggling as to where they don't have an NSF to go to get that funding, but to look at that. Our work with faculty and e-scholarship in the humanities and social science, our digitization of collections, and our work in digital preservation all contribute towards it. So I think we should be looking at being part of this cyber infrastructure. Enabling the discovery and the use and breadth of the world's knowledge. We've had a lot of discussions about these recently, looking at papers. Should we put our information out into WorldCat, which we are, where it can be discovered? The Google indexing not only of our catalog data, but even of our digital of all of our digital files. And I asked Ed recently, was the Daily Sun indexed by Google? Well, you can find out in the Daily Sun that you can find out in Google that Cornell has digitized issues of the Daily Sun, but you can't get down to the level of granularity of knowing about, you can't search on Slope Day and pull up references to Slope Day in the Daily Sun. And I think we are going to have to look at pushing down that level of indexing. We've talked about WebFeed and the ability that will give us to make our data more visible. Vivo as the virtual life sciences library is a way of both building community and then making our information more available, and we hope to be able to extend that to social sciences. And then this very interesting paper that Lorcan Dempsey, I guess I don't have it right here, has written in DLib magazine on the long tail in libraries, where he's talking about the importance of aggregating supply and aggregating demand. And then they talk about Netflix, for example, that Netflix, the long tail, is we see it that we're able to have older material that may circulate only infrequently in our library be discovered by making it more visible. But he's also talking about aggregating the demand in a way that pushes it above the level of the individual library, and that it's only by moving to this meta level that we will achieve the great success we want in having people discover and use the wealth of our information. And he's making points that ILL accounts for such a small portion of our circulation, and that's what we want to be doing is increasing the use of our collections by other institutions, and that's how this long tail will manifest itself. And then Catalyst is our local implementation of this idea, perhaps, that Lorcan has about aggregating supply and demand, because we're talking about aggregating the physical collections of the peer information, and then being able to have economies of scale in the storage of that, growing our collections for access by our users and by users of other institutions as well. Facilitating the free flow of information. Here we have done a lot of work already, and we're moving now to talking increasingly about authors' rights. The Faculty Library Board has been talking about that. And Friday, when I was there for the visiting committee at Harvard of the to the libraries, there was a computer scientist, Stuart Schieber, who was talking about an institutional license that would say that, you know, an author now can submit an article to a journal and can request the right to retain rights for deposit in an institutional repository or for putting on his or her own homepage. The Harvard talk was about having the institution have that right, because it's a, what is the leverage for the individual? If the individual sends off her paper to a journal and the journal says, no, we're not going to allow this, or we're only going to allow this condition, the individual has really very little leverage as they think about their tenure and promotion issues. But if the institution, and an institution like Harvard, says, you know, our faculty isn't going to publish with you unless they are able to put this in an institutional repository or make it accessible for use at Harvard or under these conditions, then that really creates some change. What Stuart said was that the Harvard Law School was very likely to do this. I was thinking, how would this ever happen? And I'm thinking at Cornell, the faculty would be very, very resistant to anything that seemed like the institution was coming in and interfering with their rights. I think Cornell faculty are very independent in that way. But it was interesting that he thought that the Harvard Law School was ready to model. And I think if you see the institution like Harvard, which actually is relatively conservative, doing this, that this will spread to other institutions. And then just to talk very briefly, I mean, we have these examples where we have open access and where we are facilitating the free flow of information. DPubs, which will be launched this summer, open source as journal or content management software. TEAL, the Essential Electronic Agricultural Library, which is making, in the developing world, information freely or available at so low cost that one could say it's freely available. Project Euclid, which is two-thirds open access, and then the archive, which continues to grow and which we're looking at expanding other directions. And just a couple of examples of the success that we're having here already with this. The ILR School has, Catherwood has worked with ILR to gather up the publications of its faculty. And I was really quite interested when I was clipping this yesterday, actually. So there are 1,500 papers in there, actually almost 1,600, but 7,200 downloads in 1 week. So you get a real sense of how that does make information available. I'm actually been tracking the paper I put up last year in DSpace so that we could talk about it in academic assembly on collaboration among libraries. That's getting about 3 uses a day, and I'm sure that I've never had any paper that was so widely read. I mean, it's just really a remarkable experience. And the same thing, the Cornell Law School, the Law Library, is participating in NELCO, which is the New England Law Library Consortium, and they are putting in the work of their faculty and papers. So it's quite... it is a movement that is growing. And then our Center for Innovative Publishing has a number of initiatives. The area of digital preservation, I really feel we are well informed about here. We've been a leader in the preservation of artifacts, and we have many people here among us who have contributed to our profession on the understanding of digital preservation issues. I'm trying to think, was it ARL that just published your paper, Anne? That I just yesterday got the note about Anne's, some work that Anne has done. Anne will be presenting at the ARL meeting in Ottawa next week after next.
She's leading a clear report on issues in digital preservation. We have many, many other people. So I think what we need to do is move. We're beginning to coalesce around some solutions. There are still a number of solutions out there, but we now need to begin really seriously. And I heard Anne say yesterday that we have well-managed collections, but not digitally preserved collections. That we need to move in a way to make sure all of our collections are well-managed, and that then we're moving into digital preservation. So we need to especially focus on our locally created content, and then the proprietary content, the material, the digital material that we're licensing. We start to insist that those come with guarantees that they are working with trusted digital repositories to ensure the longevity of that material. And then this last area, I think, is we really need to begin to move on this, which is the records management part, and so the working with administrators and scholars at the university to save our university records, our data that is being created here, course web information, the blogs and student webpages, the things that we have collected in paper form or new forms of knowledge that are now emerging. That's something important for us to collect, or we'll lose an important part of our history. And then the last issue that I see is this, this is really a grand challenge, but I felt that we had to address this, was the workforce. And I was very struck, Karen Calhoun helped organize a conference called the TIGA Conference, which was held at the end of March. And she sent out the URL for that. You can go, it's TIGA, T-A-I-G-A. And look at the papers. There are really some very interesting papers there. Jim Neal's paper, which was entitled, I forget now, The Axis of Evil, The Perfect Storm, and some other, Global Warming, or something like that. And he had this one quote, which I just thought was great, from Marshall McLuhan: our anxiety, our age of anxiety, is in great part the result of trying to do today's job with yesterday's tools. And I think that we sometimes feel that frustration, and we feel anxious about what we're doing, because we know things are changing around us, and that there are different expectations and desires, but how can we grow to be able to do that? We have lifelong learning, and again, at a conference I attended at Memorial Sloan Kettering this last month, I guess, that was focused on health sciences librarians. I was somewhat intimidated to hear that at NIH, when they hire reference librarians, they expect their reference librarians to take 2 4-credit science courses each year, if I understood that right. And I immediately thought about how terrified I would be. Even to be taking a German course today, I would be terrified, probably. But when you think of that field of genomics and some of the molecular biology issues, but that in order to be current, in order to work with the researchers, they needed to be at that level of conversation. And I was mentioning this to somebody recently, and they said, no, it's actually not that hard. You know, people are smart. They go in, they take the course material. It seems more intimidating than it is. But so I use that just as an example of probably the most extreme form of lifelong that people would have, but that this ability to stay abreast of new development is important. We have all of these new roles, and when I was talking out in the West Coast, I had a sheaf of these papers, and Lynn Grinley's strategic plan for the British Library, for example, is called Reinventing the Library. And there were other papers where people were all focused on the fact that we're not doing the jobs, those of us who did 20 or 30 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, we're not doing the same jobs, that we need to adapt and have the ability to move into those jobs through training, through hiring colleagues, that can help us stretch. And I always talk about the MBAs that are, we have a number of our staff who are going, again, I mean, I think that's sort of intimidating for me, but they're going to the boardroom program at the Johnson School, getting executive MBAs. We're hiring more attorneys. We're hiring more PhDs or masters. So we have these new skills. And then the idea that we are becoming a more diverse community and that we need to continue to focus in that area. Let's see from this. Oh, when I'm talking about anthropologists doing it. So, you know, I think our challenge, our granular challenge here is to create an environment for our library that nurtures this lifelong learning. It encourages risk-taking and really uses mistakes as opportunities to grow so people can fail and almost be celebrated for that failure. You know, you're always hearing these people say, oh, I learn lots more from any mistake than I do from success. So we need to be able to have that ability. We need to provide the education and training so all of us who are already here can continue to excel in our new roles. We are going to recruit these diverse colleagues and have this pool of talent that will show initiative, think critically, and be nimble enough to anticipate the next new thing. But at the same time, be stable enough to uphold the traditions that are the essence of librarians. And I think that was one of the things that was very interesting for talks, was to talk about, yes, you know, Google can do all these wonderful things, but what about the values that we have of free and open access to people, the value of the expert working directly with someone, so that we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's a lot I haven't talked about today. I mean, I haven't talked about our physical libraries or structures or other things. I hope that you'll find some of these challenges inspirational and motivating, but I hope you'll have others to add. I just have to end with saying the Cornell Library is really a distinguished library. And when I've been traveling, the alums of all generations have been thankful that they were able to use Cornell University Library. Really one of the other most often repeated questions is, how can we still continue to use the library? They said it's without peer. When they leave, they discover how great it is. I know we have faced challenges and pressures in the last few years. We've had overcrowded buildings, had inadequate budget. Sometimes we've had internal conflict about which was the best way to go. But we have surmounted and become an even better library. These grand challenges might seem imposing, but one of the premises of the grand challenge, you'll remember, is that it's not insoluble. I think I can't imagine a better team to work as we make our contribution grand challenges. Thank you very much. Questions. Are there other ideas that you want to present that we should be focusing on that you think are especially important, or are there things that you would differ on? We can develop our culture of risk takers.
Okay.
two comments. One comment and a question. I think one of the grand challenges we had in sort of embedded in a couple of these, move beyond that collective power of libraries. We're seeing that as a strength rather than that it redounds to our success. I mean, the power of catalysts is so exciting to me. But the question, I was stunned by the RLG-OCL merger, and I wonder, what's your take on
that? Right. Yesterday, so could you hear Anne's question? She was talking about moving from the individual organization to the collective, and then she's asking about RLG and OCLC. Yesterday there was a merger announced between these two organizations, and I immediately ran into Ed's office and said, did you see that?
And then he said, oh yeah, and here's David Banish saying it's like April Fool's. And honestly, that was my thought too. I'm thinking, what day is today? This is May. Yeah, it can't be April. Now, on the other hand, when I was on the RLG board quite a few years ago, people were recruiting me to the board and trying to convince me to stay on because they, even then, were saying, we need to achieve, they might not use the word merger, but a deeper integration between OCLC and RLG. So this is something that has been an idea among the leadership for a number of years. My sense was that it was great, that it was, it was another way of aggregating the supply and the demand. It was, instead of our, think of it, all the efficiencies that it could create in the sense of having to think about working with two organizations, we can focus on one. One presumes that we will eventually rationalize some of the relationships we have with, and Pat's nodding her head, so I'm thinking about ILL and shares. And is there any way that we can, instead of having to think, oh, are they an RLG library, are they this, that will get automated in some way, or it will be some way that will save us time and effort. So my feeling is extremely positive about what it will do for us. And for RLG, which is an organization where I worked many years ago and that I have a great deal of affection for, I think it's a very healthy transition for it, where it was struggling economically. They will have the deeper infrastructure of OCLC to build on, so I think it will be a very good change. Yes, Terry. Right, so Terry was asking, saying, well, I don't see as fully reflected in this the partnerships with faculty. What is our role in working with faculty in their educational mission? I do think they are, that's an important area where we should be devoting time. And so that was part of what I was thinking was included when we're talking about saving things. So, and one of the things that's very interesting, which I really didn't talk about, but when they talk about data curation and e-science, is not just saving things that are ephemeral and for historical purposes, but there's really a lot of discussion about getting more mileage out of your investment. So, and there is work that's being done right now on campus in the library where faculty members have collections or assets that, and they are reaching the end of their active careers as educators at Cornell, and they want to ensure that other people are able to use this information. I think that's an important role, both on the digitization side, and then on the saving side, and then on the use side, the visibility. So it fits in all across the board. Do you have any
question about that? Well, you talk about more like that, collecting rather than assets, the videos and the tutorials. Mm-hmm. And that. So I should broaden up.
I think it is, but it's one of those things probably where every person puts his or her own interpretation on what it is. I mean, you do think about it as those large data sets. I agree. But I think what I'm talking about more broadly is look around all these materials that are important for students, are important for learning, important for research. That's where our role is expanding. We're way beyond books, and we're even way beyond videos, although I was astonished when we had the Library Advisory Council here and was going on a tour, and Margaret was leading, that she and the Media Center said the Media Center accounts for 28% of all in circulation. And that was a real wake-up call for me about how actively our visual collections are being made. Karen. Okay. I see our time is up. the library management team has actually been working with others on looking at our priorities. We met with the leaders of the priority team about where they are and what their recommendations are for the future. And we've looked at a number of those priorities and have we're just at the point of finalizing the approval of various recommendations that have been made. And then, so longer term though, I think what we will be doing is getting a small group of people together to plan for a planning process. I know that sounds really bad. What do you do? You get a committee together to do this. But one of the things we want to make sure to do is to have a broad involvement on the part of the library staff in contributing to where we're going to be investing our efforts. So I think what we'll have are probably, on one hand, some broad themes that will emerge as these are agendas which we wish to pursue. We'll have a group of people talking about the themes and then what are the, and that will happen over the course with, and we've been talking about the time horizon. And should we be looking at 5 years, 3 years, some people said 0 years, we should only be looking at 6 months of time horizon. And that's one of the things that I would expect to be making a recommendation on. I think there is a sense that things change so rapidly that we can't be looking very far out in the future, because in the space of 2 years, Google keeps making all the announcements it's been making, and RLG and OCLC merge, and so I mean, we need to be nimble and able to roll with the assumption. Okay, there's my timekeeper saving me. Thank you very much.